there, here, and in Isaiah's letter, had to mean something. Claire Greet dominated pretty much every frame, and with good reason. She was a beauty in the realest sense of the word. It wasn't sultry or sexualized. There was an innocence to her. She possessed the kind of beauty that would be out of place today in today's world of manufactured precision. She lined up outside the Peabody with other hopefuls, suitcase stuffed to overflowing on the ground by her feet, while Thesiger moved down the line, picking out people to go inside. Josh couldn't help but think that with it being a Hitchcock movie, no matter how desperate they were supposed to be, the lucky ones would be those who didn't find themselves with a room inside. He sipped at his coffee, and then decided to make himself comfortable on the mattress, despite the health hazard it posed. The scene changed, moving along the street toward the wharf, the camera focusing on one of the big steamships on the Thames, presumably highlighting the influx of poor fresh off the boat and the increased pressure their arrival put on the city. The imagery was every bit as stark as anything Hitchcock had ever captured on film, with subtleties woven into the fabric of the city itself. But there was no denying it was flawed, erratic, and without the lies of words to drive it, there was no tension. Josh found it difficult to concentrate on the film, realizing that there was nothing of any real worth to be found within it. He slumped up against the wall, his head dipping as the night gathered around to claim him. And then he saw him, a face in the crowd, and all thoughts of sleep fled. Josh pushed himself up from the mattress and scrambled to his feet. He knew that face. Josh had almost missed him because the camera moved on quickly. But it was so jarring to see someone he knew in a film that was over 90 years old. Seth Lockwood. Seth was just milling around in the background, not actively part of the film. Josh watched him. He did nothing. He didn't move. Didn't interact with any of the main cast. But in one unguarded moment, Josh saw something. The camera caught him looking at Eleanor Raines when he thought no one was watching, and it stripped away all deceits. His expression was purely covetous. His need stark, urgent, like it hurt so much to look at her, he wanted to claw his eyes out, and yet he still couldn't look away. Hitchcock had seen it too, and focused the lens on Seth. The director, like the magician he was, used Seth as a classic piece of misdirection, creating the illusion of an external threat to the heroine, something from outside the Peabody. It created doubt in the viewer's mind, allowing the real threat to move throughout the film unnoticed for a while longer. Josh watched the frames again, stopping the projector when he had seen enough. It had to be Seth, he thought, even though he'd never met the man, but the similarity between him and the newfound cousin who had waylaid him in the yard behind the Scala a few hours ago was unmistakable. He had cracked a joke about the apple not falling far from the genetic tree in their family. In every good joke, there was more than a grain of truth. The similarities were beyond unnerving. There was nothing else of note in the 27 minutes of footage. Eleanor Raines occupied the screen for perhaps 2 minutes of that time. Seth Lockwood barely 30 seconds, and never without Eleanor. But those were the only 2 minutes of number 13 that mattered. 14. Blood, sweat, and tears. How far would you go for love? What extreme becomes too extreme? Would you kill to save someone you loved? Of course, and without a second thought in Seth Lockwood's case. 2 people? 5? What about someone you were obsessed with? Once you were committed, it was the same, wasn't it? If anything, obsession was purer. There was no art so dark as the human art, as far as he was concerned. It was all about committing to a course of action and sticking to it no matter the cost. That single-minded determination was the difference between winners and losers, and Seth didn't lose. Ever. He closed the door. He needed to be alone and couldn't stand all of Gideon's grousing and worrying. How could the old bastard be the fruit of his loins? It wasn't as though he'd been born without a spine. At one point, in the late 50s and into the early 60s, he had been one of the most feared men in London. Seth knew. He'd watched from afar. But the years had sucked the backbone out of his boy, leaving a jelly-like invertebrate in the gangster's place. It was sickening, really, to see him so diminished. Seth would have crushed the kid if he hadn't needed him. But good things came to he who waited, and Seth was nothing if not patient. This was still his city, no matter what year it was. He looked at the clock on the wall. It was time. It didn't matter what the hands showed. He'd always known it was time. He'd known since he'd set foot in the church for Boone's funeral. Things were happening that couldn't unhappen. He'd caught sight of Eleanor among the mourners along the side of the road, watching as the funeral procession went by, but he hadn't been able to catch her. That she was so easily able to slip in and out of Glasstown now was a worry. It meant that the Duomas, holding the grand illusion in place, were failing faster than the damned magician had anticipated, which was bad, but unavoidable. He didn't understand exactly what the magician had done, or how he had done it, but he knew enough to grasp the implications when one of the ancient lenses cracked. That shouldn't have happened. The integrity of the entire illusion depended upon the glass. A single flaw could shatter it completely once and forever. And then what for him? Was he simply supposed to allow time to catch up with him and die like a normal man? He needed to replace the lens and restore the Duomas, and he couldn't do that without Damiola's help, which wasn't going to be easily had, given that the illusionist had vanished from the face of the earth back in 1924. Of course, the fact that the lens had cracked was also the only reason he was out here now. He wasn't blind to the irony. It was an unintended casualty of war. A German bomb had taken down the building it was anchored to, and in the process opened the way back here. He'd paid laborers to repair the house a long time ago, but hadn't concerned himself with the crack, because it allowed him to slip in and out of hell as he pleased. That broken glass could end up being the single most important piece of luck they'd had, since Damiola sealed up their little slice of London town, and they'd disappeared supposedly to live happily ever after. Without it, he would never have known Isaiah's obsession had been handed off to a new generation. Seth had hoped that after all this time, they'd have given up looking, and gradually forgotten all about Eleanor, him, and everything else, and just gone on with living their way into the future, while they left the past where it belonged. He was in the manager's office of the Hunter's Horns. A leather-inlaid mahogany desk dominated the room, along with a high-backed green leather chair that would have looked at home in the Bank of England circa 1880. The room smelled of that well-waxed leather. An old cinema projector was the only thing on the desk. Filing cabinets and shelves filled with ledgers going back to the 20s finished the furnishings. Behind the desk was a battered green capstan safe. Seth knelt in front of it and pressed his left hand to the cold iron as he spun the dial. He knew the combination off by heart. 13-01-24. The numbers would have meant nothing to anyone else, but they were more than just dear to his heart. They were the foundation of his entire life. The 13th of January, 1924, was the day Damiola had pulled off his greatest trick ever and hidden away Glasstown from the rest of the world. It was the day he had finally owned Eleanor Raines, body and soul. He didn't think about her heart. He'd never owned that. Seth had accepted that a long time ago. It had taken a while, but he had learned to be happy with what he had. Seth was a practical man. He had acted impetuously, releasing one of the rushes. It had been a mistake. He knew that. He'd known it at the time. But when his boy had questioned him, it had only made him all the more stubborn. That wasn't a good trait. So now he needed something more surgical to send after the boy. Ideally, he would have summoned the negative, but that particular monstrosity was already patrolling the boundaries of Glasstown, keeping what needed to be kept in, in. So that left the dailies or the reels. The dailies were more creatures of defense than attack, though like all of Damiola's invocations, equally capable of wreaking havoc. They were insidious little things that came and went in the course of sunrise to sunset, only to rise again with the coming dawn. No good for a night fight. The reels came in pairs, and unlike the rushes, which were a quainter evil, what made the reels more interesting from his perspective was that they were capable of something approaching thought. If the rushes were bloodhounds, the reels were sharks. He opened the safe and removed two of the three brown envelopes in there. One contained cash, lots of it bundled up in tight wads of twenties. Another contained documents pertaining to his life, both then and now, all the papers he needed to pass in either time. The one that he wanted contained two reels of film that fit onto the arms of the old cinema projector on his desk. This was no ordinary projector. It was one of Damiola's finest creations, a prototype for what became his greatest illusion of all, the Opticron. The films it showed were no mere showreels, either. He teased the two small reels of film from the envelope, handling them with gentle firmness, cautious urgency, barely contained excitement. All of those things and more that conferred ownership and right. He unspooled a little of the film and held it to the light, looking through the frames until he found the silhouette he wanted, the comedians. Seth cleared a space out in the center of the room before fitting the reels into the projector. He winced as the brittle film cracked as he curved it around the armature and hoped it wouldn't break completely before he was done with it. He needed what was on that reel. The film cracked twice more, alarmingly, before he'd finished easing it into place and wound it on over the fractures. It stayed in one piece. The power cable snaked back across the rug to the plug in the wall. Unlike the carousel, everything in this invocation was electrical, a much more modern magic. At the time of its invention, it had been otherworldly. Now it was dated, like the mismade girl, the Chinese water torture, and other staples of the stage magician's trade. But it worked. That was what mattered. It was as simple as flicking a switch, and the reels turned. The projector was slightly unbalanced and rattled against the desktop as they did. Seth waited for a moment as the frames fed through between the lens and the flickering bulb, then lifted away the cap, bringing the image of the comedians forth. The movement caused a flickering image to be projected against the back wall, the projection stretching from the center of the floor all the way up to where it joined with the ceiling. A gray image of the city filled the wall. But that wasn't what he was interested in. The reels spooled on, until finally the comedians stepped into the frame, and were suddenly larger than life, standing on the floorboards in the middle of the room, even as the bottom right corner of the image on the wall began to blister. One obese, the other unusually thin to the point of being gaunt, both instantly recognizable to a child of a certain age. Marty Crake and Al Clamp, one of the most irreverent comic pairings of the last century. They weren't exactly darlings of the silver screen, in the way that Fatty Arbuckle and Harold Lloyd were, or the more famous pairing of Laurel and Hardy. Crake and Clamp were pioneers of black comedy. There was nothing gentle or slapstick about their physical routines. The image threatened to break up completely, a gauze of flickering frames blurring the comedians as the projection lost its focus and the film began to blister. The acrid tang of burning filled the room, as wisps of black smoke curled away from the projector. The film burned under the heat of the bulb, damaging the invocation. Something was wrong with the comedians, Seth realized. Where there should have been two men, there was only one, conjoined at hand and hip, where the film had blistered during their summoning. Behind them, the image of the city began to melt as the film burned inside the projector. The stench of sodium nitrate was overpowering now, completely drowning the subtler, richer smell of old leather. There was nothing Seth could do. He couldn't force the invocation to accelerate or rip them out of the film. They had to emerge naturally, in their own good time. But the flames did more damage to them by the second. He breathed deeply and waited. No amount of damage to the comedians would prevent them from doing what he needed them to, though it would limit their efficiency and how they could be deployed. They couldn't walk unnoticed through the streets of London if they were badly misshapen, fire-damaged freaks. The comedians looked at him, expectantly, as their film world burned out around them. Gradually, they became more substantial, taking on the physicality their comedy was famous for, until they were finally whole. Behind them, the cityscape was consumed in a blackened blister of burned film. It was like watching the end of the world through the lens of a 1920s disaster movie. The only sound in the office was the quick slap, slap, slap of the broken end of the film strip coming up against the metal projector as the reel spun around and around with nothing to show for its effort. It was done. Before the projection of the comedians could burn out, along with the rest of the film, Seth took a letter opener from inside one of the desk drawers and sliced his finger with it, drawing blood. He winced as he held the wound over the projector, squeezing it to force his blood drip onto the lens. As the first drop hit, it sizzled away on the glass, the second and third likewise, coming together to form a thin crust over the glass. Fueled by his blood, the comedians would be trapped here for as long as he needed them to serve him. Seth Lockwood sat down behind his desk. He needed to think through his next words carefully, because once the comedians were released, there was no recalling them until their task was done. He couldn't afford to waste them. He needed to think this through, and be absolutely sure he knew what he was going to demand of the conjuration, and that meant finding the precise words. Precision was vital. There was no room for misinterpretation. Once the comedians were fed, they wouldn't forget. Those words would become their lifeblood. They would draw sustenance from them. They would draw strength from them, and they would find purpose in them. The comedians waited patiently for his instructions. "It is time," he said, finally, drawing a deep breath. "The duomas around Glasstown are failing, and soon must fall. I believe Damiola left instructions for this eventuality among his things. He must have. He thought of everything. Bring them to me. Your service is not through until the duomas are restored once more and my love is safe. Do you understand? You are not spent until Glasstown is secure. There is no release. You will live on to serve until I see fit to allow you to pass." The comedians bowed their head in acknowledgement. When Craik looked up again, there were tears in his eyes. Hardly sympathetic, Clamp cuffed his partner across the back of the head, with the only hand that was actually his, and rolled his eyes exasperatedly. "This was his," Seth said, taking the bow tie out of the final envelope. He rose from his chair and met the uncanny conjuration in the center of the room. He lifted the bow tie to Marty Craik's mouth, clamping his free hand around the comedian's jaw, and forced it open so that he could feed Craik the bow tie. "Taste him on it. Taste him on the cloth. Go on." He forced it all the way down with his fingers and closed Craik's mouth, causing him to swallow over and over until he could be sure the conjuration wouldn't regurgitate it. The comedians might look human, despite the bluish light at their core, but they were anything but. When people talked about selling their soul to Hollywood, this was what they were buying. Immortality. Though not the kind of immortality they ever dreamed of. Sometimes it was better to be forgotten, to slip away, but the camera never forgot. That was the point of it, its sole reason for being, to remember. No matter how old an image was, how discolored or faded it might be, how blurred or granulated its composition, or how badly it had deteriorated, it abided. A frozen moment. An eternity, and as long as it abided, there was always going to be someone there to remember it. Damiola understood that. The magic was in sustaining the image, preserving the memory, and through his carousel, he had found a way of bringing it back to life. It was good old Hollywood magic. "It is all I have of him, but it is rich with his flavor, his sweat, drawn out by the stage lights night after night. Soaked into that material. That is him, his essence. He is inside you. The man was unique. There wasn't another like him in this entire shithole of a place. Given that, it shouldn't be hard to find him amid all the filth of London. So go forth, hunt. Do not return here until you have found his secrets. He was a magician. He must have recorded the workings of every trick he ever did. Glasstown was his masterpiece. There must be instructions somewhere. Find them. I will save his greatest creation, even if I have to tear down half of London to do it. And you will not fail me. Do you understand? Craig chewed on the black tie. The fat man looked at his other half and nodded. A star of the Silent Age, he had no words to say. There was nothing that needed to be said. Seth knew how this particular conjuration worked. There was nowhere Isaiah's Get could hide, that the comedians couldn't find him. 15. Sleepless. Julius Gennaro couldn't sleep. That in itself wasn't unusual. He wasn't the deepest sleeper at the best of times, and living in the middle of what became the last bastion for whores and junkies every weekend night, there was more than enough going on to wake him whenever he threatened to find refuge in it. He had been planning on moving out for the best part of a year, but without getting a roommate, the ridiculous property prices in the city meant it was a choice of a desirable cupboard in a decent area or this. This won for now, but it wouldn't win forever. Something had to give. There was an air of decrepitude about the entire area that could only be found in the old red brick terraces of London. It wasn't so much that they'd crumbled, as they'd been beaten down year after year through living done hard, skilled labourers being written off by the country they'd broken their backs for, their children and children's children left to grow up with a bitterness that went back generations. A wag had painted a big red NO on the Hope Street sign under his window. That just about summed it up. Tonight's insomnia wasn't just down to the usual backstreet symphony of the loved and unlovely, though. There were other reasons for it. Chemically, no doubt. The caffeine had a large part to play in his mind refusing to settle. He'd never been a coffee drinker, but Taff insisted on doing the rounds of designer cafes and the greasy spoons, putting merciless pressure on his bladder and gulping down enough caffeine to keep a herd of wildebeests going on one hell of a rampage. But beyond the chemical, there was something else. The suspicious little part of his mind that made him a half-decent copper refused to shut off. He had no idea what other officers were like, but with Julie, once his mind got hold of something, it wouldn't rest until it had worked it out. He'd worry at it, pull and push and prod until something gave. It was why he couldn't read books and made a lousy companion in the cinema. He was obsessed with knowing. And right now, lying in bed staring up at the shadows conjured by the chip shop's lights, reflected over the galaxy of plaster spirals stippling his ceiling, he was obsessing about one thing. Taff Carter had never once ducked out of clocking off. It was a stupid thing to be keeping him awake, but he couldn't let it go. The thing was, he knew his partner. Taff was a stickler for rules and regulations. He was a by-the-book kind of man. That was just who he was. Some of the younger beat cops called him Jobby Carter, short for Jobsworth, behind his back, because where they were tempted to give an inch and take a yard, Taff was a stick in the mud, or up the arse, or any other variant of inflexible that came to mind involving sticks not bending. Julie had always figured his partner was just a bit fixated when it came to routines. Until tonight. And that bothered him. So he lay there trying to work out what was different about today. And what really got under his skin was the fact that there was nothing different about it. It had been pretty much business as usual, apart from the woman in white. The same as every other day they had spent together. So why had Taff bailed on him rather than head back to the station for the change of shifts? What was so urgent he couldn't do it 10 minutes later? Julie worked backward through everything he could remember, watching the shadows change as the owner of the takeaway closed for another night, the 2 a.m. shift done. As the sign went out, it left the moon to light his cramped little room. Julie could smell the fat and grease in the air. It wasn't conducive to deep thought, but no matter how he looked at it, nothing out of the ordinary had happened. Even if the shift had ended with a bit of excitement over at the Rothery, that was a common enough occurrence. So why break the habit tonight? It could only be the woman. Taff had been single for as long as Julie could remember. Not that they talked much about sex and women, or the lack of both in their lives. Taff was more of a rugby and real ale kind of conversationalist, though he had a surprising love of jazz, which didn't quite fit with the man's rough edges, whereas Julie was your metrosexual modern man, happy to talk about art exhibitions, world news, politics, religion, changing gender roles, gay marriage, underground music, or anything else he'd found within the pages of The Guardian. Chalk and cheese. It made the shifts interesting. But as far as he could figure, the woman was the only thing that made sense. And even then it was stretching the definition of sense to a point far off in the distance. Closing time wasn't exactly the ideal dating hour, unless you were paying by the hour and didn't want to worry about the niceties of social convention. He sighed. Was he overthinking things? Was it just a case of Taff needing to be somewhere, all quite innocent, and trusting a friend to help him out, no questions asked? Maybe. Probably. But the problem was the no questions asked part. As he pondered that, Julius couldn't help but wonder if there was any significance to where Taff had dropped him off. The Hunter's Horns was right on the boundary of the Rothery, by the green and the lightning-struck tree. They used to joke that beyond that corner lay nothing, like on the old maps that said, "Here be dragons." The only reason to drop him off there, so close to the station, was if Taff's business would take him back into the estate, wasn't it? Otherwise it would have been quicker to drive on. So was he meeting a woman in the Rothery? Julie gave up on sleep for a while and went through to the kitchen area. It wasn't an actual kitchen, just a workbench and a sink, to grab a glass of milk from the fridge and sit on the windowsill in the lounge and stare out into London. By 3 in the morning he was so convinced his partner was in trouble, he sent Taff a text asking him to call, just to let him know everything was okay. But of course there was no call. Why would there be? It was 3 a.m, and Taff would be off in the land of Nod, dreaming, no doubt, of big-breasted women to a soundtrack of soft jazz. That didn't help Julius Gennaro sleep. Just after 3 he jumped in the shower. The old pipes took an age to warm up, so he suffered 5 excruciating minutes of ice-cold water streaming down his body through gritted teeth, and toweled himself off, colder than before he went in. He went back through to the kitchen area and brewed a cup of coffee, putting an extra spoonful of instant powder into the cup, and then tried Taff again. Still no answer. But again, why would there be? It was barely 3:15, and they weren't due back on duty until mid-afternoon. He was asleep, just like Julie ought to be. He pulled on a T-shirt with a faded barbed wire fist emblazoned on the chest, and a pair of jeans already worn threadbare on the right thigh. Both were relatively new, designer second-hand chic, or in other words, it cost a lot of money to look this scruffy. Julie stuffed his feet into a battered pair of Adidas, grabbed a leather jacket from a hook by the door, and headed out. It was a night for firsts, the first time Taff had cried off from clocking out, and the first time Julie had visited his partner's house. He saw a black cab on the corner and ran down the middle of the road to catch it, waving his arms above his head to make sure the cabbie saw him and didn't drive off. Clambering in the back, he gave the driver the address and settled back in for the ride. 10 minutes later, the black cab pulled up outside Taff's house. 11 minutes after he'd left the flat, Julie stood in the street looking at the dark windows of Taff Carter's bedroom. All he needed was the boombox to hold over his head. He smiled at that. He couldn't tell if there was a woman in there. Part of him really hoped there was, and that his partner was getting lucky. It would be good to be worrying about nothing. But another part of him was convinced the dark windows meant something was wrong, which, given it was the middle of the night and every other window in the street was dark, was completely irrational. There was just something about the place that felt off. Julie had two choices: ring the bell or turn around and head back to his own bed. The smart money was on option two. Not that he would have been able to fall asleep, but he was never going to do that. He rang the bell and waited. When there was no answer, he rattled the letterbox. Then he rang the doorbell some more. No answer. No signs of a light coming on upstairs. No complaints or groans from behind the door. He went down on his knees and shouted, "Taff!" through the letterbox. Rattling it loudly enough, one of the neighbor's lights came on and a hoarse voice shouted,
"Shut the fuck up, will you? We're trying to sleep. Don't make me call the police." "I am the police,"
Julie shouted back, shutting them up. He hammered on the door with his clenched fist, yelling Taff's name at the top of his voice, until a light finally came on inside. A few seconds later, his partner opened the door. Taff was dressed in a pair of piss-stained boxer shorts and a terry toweling dressing gown that hung open to the waist. He had a look of utter contentment and a pair of sunglasses on his face. He didn't say anything. He stood on the welcome mat and smiled, but there was no real welcome or warmth there. He kept the door between them and didn't move to let Julie inside. There was a faint bluish light on the landing behind him. A nightlight, maybe. But was his partner afraid of the dark?
"Jesus, Taff,"
Julie said, relief flooding his system at the sight of the Welshman. He hadn't realized how much of a state he'd managed to work himself up into until he saw Taff standing there in one piece, larger than life, a stupid grin on his face, obviously without a care in the world.
"Why didn't you answer your bloody phone, you prick? Or the door? Or just... fuck it, mate. This isn't how you treat your partner. We're in this shit together. I was starting to get really worried about you."
"Worried? Why?" Julie had to shrug ruefully at that. Why indeed? Because he hadn't clocked out. So much for doing a mate a favor.
"You know me, letting my imagination run away with itself. Are you okay?"
"I'm fine. I won't be in tomorrow, though. I'm taking a personal day. I think I deserve it. Now go away, Julie. I want to be alone,"
Taff said. There was something in his voice. Not anguish, not euphoria, but something in between that had no business being there. Taff slammed the door in Julie's face before he could ask him about it, or why he was wearing sunglasses in the middle of the night. 16. Another fine mess.
"So, what have you got for me today?"
Julie Gennaro asked the desk sergeant an hour later.
"You should be asleep, kiddo. You look like hell."
"I should be," he agreed. "But as you can see, I'm not. And I hate sitting around, so I figured I'd roll in early."
"Ah, the dedication of youth.
If that's what you want to call it.
We've got a couple of drunks sleeping it off in the cells. Melissa's in with a woman who came in to report a sexual assault. Got the dog waiting to do a rape kit. Other than that, pretty quiet, all things considered. They're having more fun over at Euston, by the sounds of it."
"Yeah?"
The desk sergeant rifled through a sheaf of papers, looking for a printout. He put it on the counter between them.
"A CCTV shot from a robbery in progress on Stevenson Way about 2 hours ago. Take a look."
Stevenson Way was a few minutes' walk from King's Cross. A fairly unremarkable street, all things considered. There were dozens just like it in a 5-minute radius of the train station. And on that unremarkable street, there was an equally unremarkable brownstone building. The street in the brownstone might have been unremarkable, but once through the door, everything inside was about as remarkable as you got, even in a city like London. This one particular building contained a hidden theatre, a miraculous floating staircase, and the largest collection of magical memorabilia in the country. It was the home of the Magic Circle. That alone was enough for it to have caught the desk sergeant's attention, but coupled with the image captured by the CCTV, it was irresistible. Why so? Because of the criminals. Julie studied the photo of Marty Craik and Al Clamp, two of the most iconic faces from the black-and-white days of cinema, captured in the middle of breaking into the magic circle. They weren't wearing their trademark bowler hats, and didn't have their familiar goofy expressions on their faces, but it was unmistakably them, even if they'd been dead for the best part of 50 years. There was nothing slapstick or undead about either of them. He assumed the burglars were wearing some sort of latex masks to hide their real faces. It wasn't uncommon to see Margaret Thatcher holding up a convenience store these days, with Neil Kinnock as her sidekick. Ronnie Reagan was ever popular, as were Elvis, Donald Trump, and Ronald McDonald, clowns one and all. Clamp's mask was perfect, right down to the detailing on the pencil moustache on the fat man's top lip. Part of the image seemed overexposed, as though a bright light had damaged the film. Looking more closely at the pair, they appeared to be joined. It was obviously a trick of the angle, but the effect was unnerving.
"Okay, you got me. What did they steal?"
Julie asked the desk sergeant, handing the photograph back.
"That's just it. Imagine all the stuff they've got in that place, right? It's full of old tricks, props, posters, programs, toys, photographs, that sort of stuff. It's all valuable, sure, and to the right sort of collector, probably priceless. But it's not like it's easily movable. I mean, some Barrow boy's hardly going to be selling it down the Portobello Road, put it that way. It's all specialist stuff. They've got a cylinder there that's a recording of Houdini's voice. A lot of old stage magicians bequeath their tricks to the society. So Craik and Clamp broke in the magic circle and stole some dead magician's trick. Why can we never get fun stuff like this?"
"Actually, according to the boys over in Houston, they took a book, not a trick. But yes, it sure beats another knifing on the Rothery, doesn't it?"
"A book?"
"According to the museum's curator, the only thing missing, as far as he can tell, is some old magician's journal. The thieves shattered the glass case it was in, along with a bunch of exhibits he'd donated, but left everything else behind."
"You've got to ask yourself what's in that book."
"That place is like the Bank of England. You can't just walk in and walk out. They've got some seriously high-end security there to protect their secrets. And these guys didn't set off any of it. That means they are good. Pros. Even so, it doesn't make much sense. This guy has been dead for 90-odd years. Every secret he had back then, no matter how revolutionary it might have been at the time, has to be pretty passé now, doesn't it? Penn and Teller have given every game away. Now it's all David Blaine and Chris Angel. Street magic. Not old stage show stuff like Paul Daniels.
Doesn't mean the right someone wouldn't kill to get their hands on it."
"True, Julie. Sadly. So we've got a robbery. A dead magician's journal stolen to order. Some collector will be locking it away in his safe, and it'll never see the light of day again. If it's valuable enough for them to go to these lengths to get their hands on it, they're hardly going to leave it lying around on the kitchen table."
"Again, very true. You're on fire today, Detective. Casting pearls before swine. And speaking of swine, will your partner in crime be joining us this fine morning? Or does he have the good sense to stay in bed?"
"I just talked to him. He's taking a personal day."
"Taff having a day off? Fuck me. Seriously. First time for everything, I suppose," the desk sergeant said. "Why don't you go up to the day room, grab a coffee, put your feet up, and I'll give you a shout when something comes in."
He did as he was told. 10 minutes later, WPC Melissa Banks came into the day room to claim one of those horrible vending machine coffees before going back into the room with her rape victim. She was giving the doctor time to take his swabs and photographs and give the girl some peace.
"Some nights I wonder what the hell I must have done to piss off the universe in a past life," she said, sinking down onto the couch beside him. "I've got a woman in there, battered bloody, half her face bruises. It's pretty obvious she's been through hell, but she can't tell me a single thing about her attacker beyond the fact he looked like a movie star. That's it.
A movie star? I ask you, Julie, what am I supposed to do with that?
Must be the night for it, Julie said. Marty Crake and Al Clamp just robbed the magic circle. She looked at him like he'd lost his mind and shook her head.
What the fuck's the world coming to, mate? I miss the old days when things were simple. The bad guys wore striped shirts and carried sacks that said swag on them.
It was never like that, Julie said, but he knew what she meant. It had felt cleaner when he was starting out. Now every fourth call was domestic violence, battery or sexual assault. The villains didn't wear striped shirts and Zorro masks over their eyes. They dressed just like everyone else. There was no way to look at someone and see the monster inside without looking at everyone and seeing a monster inside. And that way lay madness. 17. The Book of the Dead. Seth Lockwood opened the door on the bitterly cold morning. The sun was up, but frost was king. It owned every surface. There was a thin grey mist in the air, but even that couldn't hide the curious deformity of his early morning visitors. Or more accurately, visitor. Marty Crake and Al Clamp looked up at him from the doorstep. There was something a little bit pathetic about them, he thought. Anyone who happened to see the exchange would have been forgiven for assuming the two went inside holding hands. The conjoined comedians were fused at hand and hip, not holding hands. Their creation was flawed, but that didn't appear to have hindered their efforts to find Damiola's journal. He hadn't expected them to return so soon. That they had could only be good news. Seth could barely contain his eagerness as he led the pair back through to his upstairs office, where the light still burned in the projector. Seth closed the door behind them, making sure they were alone, and gave the reel on the projector's arm a push as he passed it to take up his seat behind the desk. The creature wasn't empty-handed. It clutched a leather-bound book in its two functional hands.
"Is that it?"
Clamp shrugged eloquently as Seth took it from them, the comedian silence not hindering their communication. Rather, it spoke volumes. Seth cradled it in his hands like it was the most precious thing he had ever touched, which, given what was at stake, it just might have been, if it had the answers he was looking for. The leather was soft and buttery despite its age. Seth placed it on the desktop. He ran his fingers across the cover, feeling every grain and indentation in the leather, before he cracked open the spine and turned to the first page. Being the journal of Cadmus Damiola, and containing the fundamental secrets of his art. Seth inhaled sharply. This was it. Damiola's diary. His secrets. He could barely contain his excitement as he turned to the next page. It was blank. He turned the next. Blank. And the next. Blank. Every single page in the damned book was empty. There were no secrets here. Even in death, the illusionist defied him. Excitement turned to rage as Seth drove himself up out of the seat and hurled the book at the far wall. The pages splayed open as it landed, taunting him with their emptiness.
"Is this some kind of fucking joke?"
he fumed, shoving his chair back.
"Do you think it's funny?"
The comedian said nothing. They didn't move.
"It's empty! I gave you one simple task, and you failed me! Damiola, you snivelling little cocksucker! Are you in there?"
He stared at the comedians as though they were somehow sentient, not merely projections brought to life by some ancient trickery.
"Can you hear me? I should shove my hand up your fucking arse and rip your bowels out, you prick!"
The comedian stared implacably at Lockwood.
"Can you hear me?"
He had no idea if the dead man could, if anything of him resided inside his creations, if they were still linked in any way, or if they were something else entirely. Demons, angels, ghosts, echoes. It didn't matter. He wouldn't be defied. Not by them. Not when the cost of failure was so high. He was a man of violence, born of violence, raised in violence, at home with violence, at peace with it. They might not be flesh and blood, but that didn't mean he didn't have a few tricks of his own up his sleeves that would hurt them just the same. He heard movement downstairs, probably that idiot son of his banging about in his wheelchair. Well, fuck him and fuck the wheels he rode in on. Seth clenched his fist. It would have been easy to lash out, to ride the wave of rage and unleash it in an explosive burst, driving his fists into the fuckers until they bled whatever it was creatures like them bled. But he knew from grim experience it was far more chilling to master his anger, to exist in a state of violent equilibrium. Seth pressed his fist to his own temple, pushing so hard that it hurt the plates in his skull. When he took his fist away, he was calm.
I do not accept failure.
Marcy Crake blubbered, fidgeting as silent tears streamed down his face. Al Clamp remained calm, awaiting further instruction.
One simple task. That was all you had. One task.
Clamp inclined his head slightly, then shrugged. It was a frustrating gesture, only using half of the comedian's body. Crake looked down at the floor, but not Clamp. He met Seth's challenge head on. He put a finger to his lips as though to silence Seth. But the gesture meant something else, didn't it? Quiet, hush, a whisper, secrets. What was he trying to tell Seth? That he'd somehow fulfilled his half of their pact?
You failed me, he insisted. I am your master. I brought you forth. I own you.
Clamp shook his head.
Get out of my sight.
The comedians held out their hands, as though chained and cuffed, asking for release.
No, Seth shook his head. Bring me what I need to repair the duomas.
The comedians turned and walked slowly across to the other side of the room, where they stooped awkwardly to retrieve the book from where Seth had thrown it. They brought it back to him. They held out their hands again, miming release.
You are done when I say you are done. I want that bastard's secrets.
Crake pointed at the book.
This thing is worthless! There's nothing in it! There are no answers in here!
He yelled impotently, tearing a page clean out of the journal.
Look at it! Where is the wisdom?
He crumpled the page up in his fist and walked toward the comedians.
Can you read a blank page?
He held it up before Crake and Clamp's eyes.
Can you decipher its secrets?
He waited for an answer from the silent duo.
What does it say? How do I save Glasstown from 90 years of decay and dissolution? How?
He demanded. But of course they had no answers for him. Seth shoved the crumpled page down Clamp's throat, forcing him to swallow the paper, just as he had forced Crake to swallow Damiola's bow tie.
You don't have a fucking clue!
Clamp spat out the paper, miming disappointment as he rubbed a curled-up index finger beneath his eye, as though wiping away imaginary tears. Seth drew his hand back, but checked himself a heartbeat before he lashed out and sent the projector spinning across the room. That kind of damage would have been irreparable. It might have been satisfying for a split second, but in the long run, it would have weakened him. And that would have been the action of a fool. Seth clenched his fist again, so fiercely this time his nails drew blood from his palm, slowly mastering his temper. He didn't move or say a word for the longest time, until his breathing was calm and steady, instead of the shallow, ragged pant it had momentarily become, and he had stopped trembling. Every muscle was taut with barely suppressed rage.
Give me a reason.
He said, his voice surprisingly calm given the rage inside him.
Tell me why I should snuff your flame out.
One good reason, and it is done. You have my word.
The comedians gestured toward the empty book, as though it not only had all the answers, it was their answer. Unfortunately for them, it wasn't one Seth liked. Craig's tears stained his cheeks, while Al Klemp fumbled desperately with his tie, both parodies of their iconic selves.
I gave you a chance, Seth said, sounding oh so reasonable. You did not take it. Now, given that you cannot find what I need, and have not won your release, there must be something else you can do for me. I know, he said, a slow smile spreading across his face. You can stop Boone's brat from finding the weakness caused by the damaged lens. You can stop him stumbling into Glasstown and ruining everything. Can you do that? Are you capable of getting something right?
Clamp nodded eagerly. Craig mimed walking with his fingers in the air between them.
No, Seth shook his head. On second thoughts, that's not good enough. Kill the boy. Bring me his heart. Bring me his tongue. Bring me his hands. His cock. Bring him to me in enough pieces that all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put poor Josh together again. You can do that, can't you?
Craig ran a finger across his throat, pretending to slit it from ear to ear.
I want you to remember what I'm about to tell you. Can you hear me in there, magician? If you can, then let this be written on your soul. Fail me again, and you'd wish you could die.
18. Afternoons and Coffee Spoons. Josh left the flat in Rotherhithe, armed with a map to a place that didn't exist, and a head full of questions he couldn't answer. It was going to be a different kind of day, no matter what happened to him. Daylight hadn't made things any clearer, but, and perhaps this was a small mercy, it hadn't brought any fresh revelations either. And no more movie stars had turned up at his door. That was no small thing, given the way yesterday had played out. As he crossed back over the Thames, Josh knew one thing for sure, and only one. Life wasn't about to get any less complicated. Now it was just a case of living with it. He'd woken aching everywhere from one of the worst night's sleep he could remember. Guilt at not going home, or even checking in with his sister, and warning her he wasn't coming back for the night, meaning they were going to worry about him and walk in on the wreckage of the burglary, mixed with a mind alive with the improbabilities plastered across the walls around him, made sure of that. Names that until yesterday had meant nothing to him consumed his every waking minute. Damiola, Reuben Glass, Seth Lockwood, Eleanor Raines, even Hitchcock and Glasstown, the Opticron, and, of course, Number 13. They were all alive inside his head. They were more than just names. He felt like he knew them, even the famous ones. They had faces. They belonged to a secret geography of the city that he was beginning to believe only a chosen few knew or even suspected existed. Suddenly he was one of that number. He wasn't sure how that made him feel. Special wasn't the right word for it. Endangered might have been a better fit, all things considered. And then there was the scene from Number 13 itself, that moment where Seth Lockwood looked out of the film at him, wearing his newfound cousin's face. And there was the letter in his pocket that claimed Isaiah had seen Eleanor decades after she'd disappeared. Only the woman hadn't aged a day, which, combined with the way Gideon's grandson had behaved behind the Scala, left him unable to trust anyone or anything. His head was spinning. It was all in there, churning about, refusing to settle. Josh had copied the 13 scorch marks from the floor map onto the one on the wall, along with the words, 1 for 1, before pocketing it,
noting that while they corresponded with landmarks around Spitalfields, Aldgate and Shadwell, they weren't in a straight line, Bermuda Triangle-like, or any other easily chartable geometric pattern that might have hidden an entire borough between the folds of the paper. Looking at the marks after he'd meticulously transferred them across offered up no clues either. There seemed to be no rhyme or reason to any of them. But they had to mean something, didn't they? He felt the first fat, heavy drops of rain as he made his way up Mansell Street, past the shiny arch of the Tower Gateway DLR station, and the insurance offices and windows into a telesales world they offered, reminding him that tomorrow he had to return to the real world, his day spent chained to a desk chasing cold leads. He continued walking toward Aldgate, and eventually to the first landmark he'd drawn on the map, which turned out to be a stuffy little antiquarian bookstore, wedged in between a thoroughly modern coffee shop with its mass-produced identical goodies, and a pawnbroker's with one of its tarnished brass balls missing. The words, Aldgate Librum, were written in an arc of flaking gold across the window, and beneath them, Purveyors of Fine Escapes Since 1929. Meaning 5 years before, when Eleanor Raines disappeared, it had been something else. Unfortunately, there was no way of knowing what. He stepped back into the road and looked up, checking out the facade. He couldn't see anything remarkable about the building itself. Like something out of Goldilocks, it wasn't too big, wasn't too small, and was probably just right. Shading his eyes, Josh peered in through the rain-streaked glass. He couldn't see anyone moving about inside, but the paper card hanging from the window promised that the place was open. He tried the door. It creaked open, the old hinges desperately needing oil. Josh was hit immediately by the smell of old books as he stepped inside, one of the most unique and to some romantic fragrances in the world. To Josh it was just overwhelmingly musty, like there was no nourishment in the air to breathe. The interior of the Librum was crammed full of books of every variety imaginable, every age and condition, with weathered boards and cracked spines. Some of them had been loved like old friends, while others, still pristine, had been cherished like assets waiting to be cashed in. A well-dressed old man, in cravat and morning suit no less, looked up from a ledger he was laboring over to smile at Josh as he took the rain out of his hair.
"Welcome to my humble library, my new friend," the old man said warmly. "I like to think we have the finest selection of out-of-print and antiquarian texts in the city, but I'd probably be lying if I said that."
He winked conspiratorially, which made Josh smile despite himself.
"Thanks. I'm just happy it's dry in here," Josh said.
"Might I inquire if you are looking for anything in particular? We have a good selection of philosophy and psychology. Religion is always a favourite, as of course are language and literature, while the classics are a mainstay of any shop like ours. We do have a rather fascinating local history section, if I do say so myself."
He must have noticed the way Josh's interest perked up at the mention of local history, because he came out from behind his counter and swept a wide, all-encompassing arm out to invite him to try his luck.
"Pick a book, any book," the gesture seemed to say. "We are rather at the mercy of what our customers bring in, or more often than not bequeath, as we help move a lot of collections for families of the departed, so there's no guarantee we have a particular book, but that's part of the fun. You never know what you might find. Rather like a lucky dip. You are more than welcome to browse what we have. Make yourself at home, and feel free to ask questions. If I can possibly help you with your search, I will. I've spent so long in here among the stacks, I'm pretty sure I know every book inside out."
It was one of the more peculiar sales pitches Josh had ever heard, but like the shop itself, it had a certain charm. Josh wandered over to the local history section and started to scan the spines, not really looking for anything in particular, but hoping something would catch his eye.
"I don't suppose," he ventured after a few minutes,
You've got anything about an area called Glasstown, have you?
Glasstown?